Accession number 22077, Reel 2.
Moyes Metcalf, Reel 2. So, how did the NCOs treat you on the whole? Did they treat you as young lads and make allowances, as it were?
No. Or? No. It's one of the things that upset me as a boy before I became a little more in the regiment. You were treated like dirt. I'm not joking. Boys were like pregnant snakes' bellies, as low as that. You were treated pretty shoddily. I was very fortunate, and I say this with all the best grace I can. I was a Salvationist, and on Sunday I went to the Salvation Army. I was still in civis. They didn't know who I was till I told them. And the officer there, a young ensign and his wife, I said, I can't stay to the after meeting because I have to be back in barracks by 9 o'clock. And they took me back in their car. And the next day I was sent for by my company commander. And and he said, you're a Salvationist boy. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, the lady came up with her husband yesterday. She was the officer in charge. And said that... what normally happens on Salvation Army, you know, they have an after meeting. And I said, yes, sir, because I always used to stay for after meetings at home. He said, well, you couldn't stay because you had to be in barracks. Right. He said, well, I'm going to give you permission. As long as the officer brings you back by 10 o'clock, you can stay with him. And I mean, don't get me wrong. The boys thought I was a cat's whisker because I was allowed to do this. They all wanted to be Salvationist. But no, that's, you know what I mean. And to me, it was wonderful. And they were very, very kind to me. And I used to go there for lunch on Sundays as well. And Harry Timmins and his girlfriend, my Lance Corporal, he also was very kind to us boys. He was the only one who really was, I think, except two men in the band. But that's, you know, you can't pick people out now. But I loved my drum days. But what I wanted to say was, the first Sunday in my army days, I was on church parade in my red uniform. I thought I owned Gravesend when I was marching down there with my drum, I'll tell you. And I knew all the marches. And when we got there, we had to go into a little room, the other denoms, because we didn't go into church in those days. It was, you know, it really was most difficult. And there were two other Salvationists and Methodist chaps and so on, about 11 of us. And the minister's wife used to give us a cup of tea and we'd stay there until we came out. But I've always remembered that day. I've always remembered it. I was so proud, I really was. And then I stayed in the drums for a while. And there was, I told you I was keen on sport. I learned to throw the javelin and the discus, not well at the time, and to put in the shot, 100 yards. And the chap who taught me was my Lance Corporal Hobbs, who was the band euphonium player. He taught me on my instrument. I was an E-flat bass player later. So when the time came to go into the band, and as it did, we had to see the bandmaster first. Mr. Gumley. Very nice man, Mr. Gumley. He had us all in at once, and he told us various things. And then he said, what instrument would you like to play? And he went round, you see, and the boys said what they would like to play. And when he came to me, he said, and what would you like to play, Metcalf? I said, I'd like to play the cornet, sir. Of course, I had a tooth out in the front. He said, what, with a mouth like that, you know? He said, you'll be on the E-flat bass. That did upset me. E-flat bass, great big thing, and I was only a titch then, apart from the fact I didn't like the instrument. And he said, I'm going to tell you something now. There's a little book here called The Elements of Music. And on the first page, it tells you all about scales and intervals. I want you to read that page. And when you've learnt them, you can come to me any time. And the first boy, I'll give him a shilling. Well, he went outside, I knocked the door and I said, can I see you, sir? And he said, what is it, boy? I said, I know my elements because I learnt them from my music teacher. And he looked at me and he said, are you sure? And I said, yes, sir, I learnt them before. So he had me in and he dodged about with staves and scale and all the rest of it. And I knew them all right. So he said, well done, son. And he gave me a shilling and he said, you don't like the idea of being on the E-flat bass, do you, son? I said, no, sir. He He said, are you musical? I said, yes, I've had singing training. And my mother used to get records from the persons whom she worked with. And I knew quite a lot of good... I used to stand in front of the mirror conducting. That was my what, and that's what I wanted to be when I joined the army after. So anyway, he said, you come with me, sonny. He took me into the band room, and as we got into the band room, 50-odd men in there, they all stood up, as they did when the bandmaster arrived. And he said, Stormman, get me the 1812 overture, please. So we got the 1812 overture, and there were four E-flat basses and one double B-flat bass, the band sergeant. And he said, right, gentlemen, pick it up from letter G, or whatever it was, and I don't want you bassists to play, you understand? Don't play till I tell you. And they played. That doesn't sound like the 1812 overture to me. And then suddenly, I don't know whether you know it, but there's a place where you go, lum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum-pum. Then they played the national anthem, lum-pum-pum-pum. And I, he said, bassists came in and bum-pum. And it was just, I couldn't believe it. I'm not joking. I mean, I was only a young kid. And he stopped the band and he said, what do you think of that, boy? I said, oh, it's wonderful, sir, because it was wonderful. And all these chaps were looking at me. And he said, you see what I mean? Every instrument's necessary. And basses wouldn't sound... 1812 would be nothing, boy. And I realised it wouldn't be. That cheered me up a bit. And then he said, is there anything else you would like, boy? I said, oh, yes, sir. I'd like to conduct the band. I'm sorry, there was a breathless hush in the clothes tonight. And then they all started laughing, you see. But he was quite serious. He said, would you? I said, oh, yes, please. And what would you like to conduct? Could I conduct the light cavalry overture by Supé, please? They're all laughing, but they got it out. And I stand there, tapped the stand, and I had them in my... I'm not joking. I was musical, and I loved it. And they all clapped when I finished, and he said, you'll be all right, son. And I used to practice. We had small bands in those days. There wasn't a lot of money about, and the band had more than most of them. Bands were considered the gentlemen of the regiment. And my last few months with the regiment there was very, very good. I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And Jack Hobbs, who became the RSM later on, and he got a quartermaster's commission, but that's another story, Jack. And came the time for me to go to Woolwich. They had a tattoo in those days at Woolwich, and I was to go, but it was the day of my first class examination. I had never seen a rugby match. Although there was rugby played, I'd never seen a match. And the 28th were playing someone that day from Chatham, naval group. And I was keen to see this game. And in the morning, I had done my mathematics. And in the afternoon, I was to do geography. And I did it very quickly. I loved geography, and I was pretty fair. Maths, I was a bit dubious about. Anyway, I went down to watch this game. And they had just started when I arrived there. And suddenly, I felt him again behind me. It was strange. Whenever the RSM was about, there was an aura somewhere. And he said, what are you doing here, boy? I said, I want to watch the game, sir. He said, I thought you were supposed to be on leave. Now, two of us had been kept behind to sit our exams. The other boys who were going abroad had gone on leave. And we were 11 days late. So I said, no, sir, I had to sit my exams. He said, have you finished? I said, yes, sir. He said, right, go and get your kit, and I'll get you to the station. You're going home, going on leave, straight away. Got my pass, and I said, but, sir, I'm supposed to be at Woolwich tonight. I've got my red uniform packed. Never mind, son, you're going home. And I went home. And when I got to Templemead, it's Swindon or Bath, I changed in the toilet into my red uniform. And when I got, I came down the Templemead's runway, and I got the tram, got off at Ashton Wills's factory at Raleigh Road, and I walked down just as my school was coming out. My school was right on the corner. And they're saying, oh, Harold, you just not look wonderful, you know, dress codes and all. My God, I thought I owned the place. And I walked up my street, and there was a dear lady, a miss, she'd never married. Her name's gone from me at the moment, but she lived in number 5. And as I walked up the street, she said, oh, Harold, your mother will be proud of you. Tickled me to death. I had a leave. And
so you were going abroad?
Yes, we were going to Egypt.
Okay, right. And so the whole 2nd Battalion was going?
No, just a draft to the 1st Battalion.
Right.
You know, the 100 men and the boys to go to the draft to the 1st Battalion.
So the boys in the band were going?
That's right, yes.
Right.
Okay. We had enlisted for the band for the 1st Battalion.
Right. So what did you feel about going abroad?
What did I think about it? Oh, I was longing to go.
Yeah.
I didn't want to leave my mum, but I wanted to go to Egypt. It was one of the places that was just wonderful.
Right.
And on the 11th of November, I thought, well, I'll go up to the centre because there's going to be a big do. And I put my khaki uniform on. I went up to Coronation Road, which along the cut, as we call it, where the river is. And a car pulled up beside me, an open car. And there was a young second lieutenant there. And he said, where are you going, boy? I said, I want to go to the centre, sir. I'm going there myself. Pop in. And I hopped in and we chatted about, he wasn't a Gloucester man. And he said, I'm sorry, I won't be able to take you back. I said, that's all right, sir, thank you very much. Anyway, I've always remembered it because at 11 o'clock, everything stopped, everything. No one, didn't hear a horse clapping or anything, you know, in those days. And then I came up to Fierce Corner to get the tram to come home. And I got inside the tram at Fierce Corner, that's Bristol Bridge in Bristol. It was Fierce Corner then. There was a big jeweler's shop there. And I got on the tram, and it always waited a few minutes because it was a single line track down to St. Redcliffe, Mary Redcliffe Church. There were all ladies in there. I sat in the bottom, right in the corner, and in came the conductor, fares please, and when he looked at me, he said, oh, bloody Gloucester's, eh? He's got that back badge for running away. That was it. I was very angry. And, of course, I said to him, you want to be careful what you're saying. I said, we got that badge for something that you know nothing about. It had a lot of you swearing as well. And these women were obviously taking notice. And I said, you better apologise or I'll punch you on the nose. Well, he didn't apologise, so I punched him on the nose. And all the women said, sirs, and that was it. But of course, the tram couldn't go till the conductor pulled the bell. The driver came round because, being a single track, the cars coming up on the double track used to stop by St. Mary waiting for this ruddy tram to come down. In fact, when we got there, about 14 cars waiting to come up. Anyway, that's something else. But I was scared. They took this driver and washed him up in Fears Corner. He never took my fare, by the way, on the way down. I must digress here because when I told my mother at home, she said, you might get into trouble. I said, I don't care. You know, Gloucesters were Gloucesters, and believe me, it was drilled into us, by the way, about that, you know.
They taught you a lot about the history.
Always, 1821, where the back badge is on Alexandra. It was one of those things, the first thing you learned, first thing you did in your third class examination, you know, where you got the back badge. Jolly wonderful it was. Anyway, my mother was upset. Some months later, while I was just before we left Egypt, by the way, I had a letter from BT and CCR, British Tramways and Carriage Company, apologising for the conduct of their conductor. I would have had it now, except we lost all our things in Burma. But my mother was upset. She said I'd get into trouble. I came back off leave. We had an extension. And we were due to leave on the 15th of November. And I arrived back in barracks on the night of the 14th of November. And all the boys' kits were up there with their helmets, solar topies. And I had to go and get my kit. I got my kit. And the instructions were that every draft that went abroad had to go to the station in khaki drill and helmets on and march to the station to the joy of all the, you know, the people. There were quite a lot of people. It snowed. It snowed. And by the time we got to the station, we were soaked. And we went down to Southampton. And there was this glistening ship, HMT Somersetshire. Beautiful. Big blue line all the way around. And when we got on, oh my God, it stank. I'm not joking. I mean, I can almost be sick now thinking about it. It really was awful. And the boys, guess where? Right down in the bilge, right down the bottom.
So how many, this was the, just a draft of 100 men?
That's right.
Plus the boys.
Correct. That's right. Correct. We had one officer with us. I've forgotten his name now. It doesn't matter. We had an uneventful trip, a bit rough in the bay. The only time I've ever known it to be rough when I was through, but it was a bit rough in the bay. The food was awful, and I understood why the ship smelt so badly. Quite often they'd fall down the steps when the ship was in, you know, I'm not joking, and a lot of the stuff went right down in the corners. It was never really cleaned. You'd come around in the morning and see that everything was wonderful, you know, with his fingers. But I think that's how it was. It was awful. I'm not joking. We stopped at Jib and we stopped at Malta. The boys were not allowed off. And we got to Alexandria. And Alex, early in the morning, and we paraded. And the officer said, you will go over in dozen at a time to get your food from the cookhouse over there and bring it back here to eat. Yes? I'm sorry. The first 12 blokes went over, they got their food, but as they came out, these great big birds came down and they took all the food away. Kite hawks, they were called. We did not call them kite hawks. You can imagine what they were called. But and of course, they're running, trying to get this. I couldn't believe it. And this happened all the time. At the end, the boys had to go and get theirs. So when we got over there, it was quite a nice meal. An egg and bacon and chips or mash or something. And I said to the sergeant cook, could we eat ours in the cookhouse? He said, yes, son, of course you can. There's a dining room there. The silly buggers never even thought about it. They'd all been over. No one has said anything. This was typical army, of course, really. And we all went and had our food in there. Of course, it was out to play when we got back. And we went down from Alex to Cairo. I thought the train had square wheels. It was an awful journey, really. It was awful. And we went then. We disembarked. We got off the train. And we were bussed. We were bussed from the station to Abbasiyah Barracks, Cairo.
The Abbasiyah.
Abbasiyah. A-B-B-A-S-S-I-A. Abbasiyah Barracks.
What were they like? What did they look like?
Very large, very roomy, big pillars on the veranda, quite large veranda. Very, very old, but very good.
Right. So you were quite impressed. This was somewhere most
impressed. Most impressed. It really was a very good barracks. Mm. There weren't many facilities there. The toilet facilities were not good. Away from the barracks, you had to go, and it was quite difficult till you got used to it, like everything else. But apart from that, there were no punkos or anything. You had no air movement at all. The barracks were just barracks. Mm.
It was very hot then.
Very hot. No, sorry. It wasn't hot.
In November.
Winter time, we wore khaki in the day, in evening. Mm. In the daytime, you wore khaki drill. Right. But in the evening, you wore, in the winter time, khaki uniform.
Right. So what were your duties there?
Same as before, band. We had band, except we used to have to sit in with the band, not necessarily to play unless you were good enough, but to turn over for the you know, and see that you could read your music, etc. We also, at that, from 16 upwards, you did rifle drill as well, yes?
So you've got a rifle then?
No boys were rifles. You had to borrow them from the bandsman, you know. That was a special assignment.
How did you get on with the bandsman?
Extremely well. Some more than others. I was very, very fortunate. The boy I mucked in with, when we got there, they all said, where'd you come from, blah? He said, I used to live at Horfield. I said, oh, really? Yeah. Because I didn't know Horfield in those days. Ashton Gate was outside the gate for Lawford's Gate and all the other gates in Bristol. So I didn't know Horfield Barracks up here. And he said, no, my dad was in Gloucesters and we lived in Barrack, in Barrack Quarters. He said, my brother Bob is the band sergeant, Bob Jarvis. And John Jarvis was my great mucker. We stayed together for years, even after he came out of the army. But John and I were good muckers, and his young brother, Bob Kerr, not... His brother, young brother, came over some years later. But that's another story. He was a bug merchant. We used to call him Bugsy Jarvis. He loved to collect insects and snakes. However, John and I, we from the first time we met, we became very firm friends. And John was a butterfly man. In Singapore, he had a wonderful time. Anyway, we were introduced to the bandmaster, Mr. J.K. Hawks.
He bandmaster of the 1st
Battalion. And he went, at one occasion, when he left the regiment, he went to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, actually. But he was a very nice, a real gentleman. I mean that in the nicest sense of the word, too. Very nice chap. And the band sergeant was a bass player, and he taught me my instrument, or I went on with it. I wanted to go to Narrow Hall, but I never made it, because I was a vocalist anyway. That's another story. The boys did very much like we did in England, practice physical training. I learned to play hockey there. Drum Major Foxwell was in 1st Battalion, and Drummy Foxwell was a very good hockey player. They had a good hockey team, and I didn't want to play hockey. That was a girls' game, I thought, till I played the first day. I didn't know much about it, but I came off, I had no knuckles left, the skin was all white, and every time you got grazed, you have an injection. All the boys were having an injection. We were straight to there, my room. It was one of those things, you know, the sand was... It was deadly, really and truly.
What was in the injection, do you know?
I don't know, TAB, I think, I don't know. Yeah. But it was on account of being caught with sand, you know.
Right. So had you had any injections before you went abroad?
Yes, we had the usual. I don't know what they were then in those days. We had quite a few, actually. And the drum major... Foxwell, he said, some of you boys will make good hockey players. We loved it later on, but then it was awful. And playing on sand wasn't very much fun, by the way. And there was a huge place called the Slade Ground in the city, the only green place there was to play sport. Anyway, I got on well with most of the band chaps, very well, in fact, except for the Lance Corporal in charge of us. His name was Lance Corporal Kent. They didn't call him Kent. I'm not going to say any more about that. But he was the most lovely oboe player, not the only one I've ever heard, but he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But he was a pig and a man who should never have been in charge of boys, really and truly, however.
What did he do? What was his particular...
Well, he just didn't care. All he thought about was his instrument. He went back to Narrow Hall as a bandmaster later, but no one cried when Kent, not even the men in the band. They didn't like him. He wasn't liked, but he was a brilliant. I could sit and listen to him for hours playing his oboe. Anyway, that was Kent. And just before Christmas Eve, actually, my chum John said, we're going out to the Dead City tomorrow, Mick, for 14 of us. That was there were more than that boys in the band at the time. Nearly all of them were due on their man service. They're quite getting on for their ages. And 7 of them had been to the Duke of York's military school, my chum amongst them, you know, they'd all been there. And they were real smart lads anyway. So we're going to Dead City. I said, what's that entail? He said, well, you want a hot water, you want your water bottle, and we'll go down to the Naffy and see if we can get a square-faced bottle for you. I said, what's that for? He said, oh, you'll find out. So we started off on Christmas morning to go to the Dead City. It was a lovely morning, and we walked across the desert. I got my water bottle to drink and my square-faced gin bottle for whatever I didn't know. And we came suddenly across. We went down into a dip, and suddenly in front of us, there was this wonderful, wonderful hill of sand, all different colours, blue and green and red, you know, absolutely incredible, really and truly. I can see it all now, really, when I shut my eyes. And he said, this is it, Mick, get your water bottle out, you go up there and you put some black sand in, and then it'll sink to the bottom of your water bottle. And I had a layer rainbow of sand in my... I would have had it now if we hadn't. I kept it, of course, when we were in Burma. That was wonderful. In the Habersack, we went on to this place called the Dead City. They were excavating there. In those days, they didn't have large, wonderful excavators like they have now. Most of it was being done by Egyptian labour. They did have some equipment. We arrived there, and there was English, American, Belgium, all sorts of people in charge. And we got a Belgian man who spoke very good English. And he said, I take you, show you things. Well, whenever I think about it, I can't believe it. But he took us in one place, and there were a pair of gates as wide as this room. Gold. They weren't gold painted, they were gold. If you don't believe me, you go to Casna Royal Museum in Cairo. They're there now because, you know, I'm not joking, because we saw them later on. But it was absolutely incredible.
And
the whole
just been excavated there,
yeah,
had they?
Yeah.
And they were still in situ.
Still in situ. Right. And honestly, how can I explain this to you? This chap said, we're going to unearth a tomb this morning. You can come down with us. And we boys all behind, because there's a little narrow corridor, and there was this great big stone door on stone hinges. You know, it took three blokes to open it. And it was getting colder as you went down. It was getting colder. And he said, there'll be two or three of these doors, mate. And we went to the next one. They pulled it open. And the air was beginning to smell a bit peculiar. And then he opened the last door. I'm sorry about this. But when he opened it, my chum John and I were standing there. And in front of us, there were horses and men. You know what I mean? And suddenly, it was all gone. It was all gone. Well, I was frightened. We tried to run, but we couldn't. The boys, only John and I, and the chap said, don't worry, son, this happens all the time. As soon as the air got to it, it all disintegrated. There was a lot of hair.
Oh, and they were what? They were mummified? Or?
They must have been. I mean, they were there, the whole horses and men.
Like sort of stuffed horses.
Maybe. Yeah, that's right. And they just disintegrated. I can't, I mean, it makes me think that I'm telling lies, but it was so, I was frightened. We came outside and we were literally shaking, and the bloke said, no need to bite. He said, this happens quite often with these things. He said, can I take you up the minaret? No, I said, we'd do that later. We went round and saw them what they were doing. And the 1721st Lancers, bandmaster, Mr. Brown, there were twin brothers Browns, whom I met years later. He sent over to our bandmaster, said, your boys are going to the Dead City. If they can bring back a skull and crossbones for us, we would be pleased, because that was their badge, 1721st Lancers. So he got us beautiful hip, thigh bone, and a skull. That was it. They were all over the place in this place. Pristine. He wrapped it in a newspaper, Figaro or whatever it was, and gave it to me to bring back. But we laid it aside, and in the evening, before we came home, he took us up this minaret. And this is something I shall never, ever forget, because my chum John wasn't a religious chap. I was pretty religious in those days. I still am, actually, but nothing so much as I was as a boy. But we went up this minaret, and out in the desert, there was a bush. It was on fire, yes? Of course, it wasn't on fire. The setting sun, the red setting sun, and the heat haze, it really looked as though it was on fire. And I can remember my John saying to me, you know, Mick, I'm not religious, but now I can believe that story about the burning bush. I've always remembered it, dear old John. And it's always stuck in my mind, because it was there, literally, you know. We came back and...
I'll stop you there.
Yes.
Harold Morris Metcalf, end of Reel 2.